Mendelspod.com, advancing life science research, connecting people and ideas.
Last week, we featured a regulatory expert weighing in on the recent FDA letter to 23andMe. Today, we're going to look at the issue of regulating DTC genomics from a different perspective. Golson Lyon is an assistant professor in human genetics at the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory. In 2011, with some colleagues, Golson identified a new genetic disease that caused the death of a four-month-old child. Yet, Golson was unable to share the results of the family's genetic tests with the family. Recently, he authored a blog, "Stopping 23andMe Will Only Delay the Revolution Medicine Needs."
Find out how to promote your brand by underwriting quality content. Go to mendelspod.com/underwriting.
Welcome to the program, Golson.
Thank you for having me.
Really happy to have you on. This topic is quite dear to your heart. You've become a fan of 23andMe. Why is that?
I'm a fan because I feel like we're going through a revolution in terms of informatics, and I feel like only certain companies like 23andMe really have mastered big data analytics and also designing web interfaces that are easy to use and interactive. But you know, let me just say from the outset that I don't own shares or have any financial interest or any financial conflict of interest in any company, including 23andMe. And so
you like the platform. You liked what they did.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a customer. I've submitted saliva samples to them twice. Once, the second time was when they rolled out a new microarray, and so they updated my my genotyping, and I've been using their system, and also I've been reading their papers. Over the last couple of years, they've had every major genetics conference. They usually have multiple posters with very interesting findings, which are enabled by having a very large data set with detailed phenotypic information as well as the genotyping array information that they have.
What would you say to those who say that, yeah, it's a great project, but it's a research project?
I mean, I think that that has to do – that really does boil down to one's philosophy in terms of paternalism versus libertarianism. And for me, I think knowledge is power, and I personally feel that people should be able to have access to their genomic information. I think that that some people would – just sort of frown upon medical interpretation being given to various people. And some of the commentators out there sort of seem to try to want to do some fear-mongering by saying that, people are going to be acting on some of the information given to them by 23andMe. But in reality, there's really no evidence that that has really occurred on any kind of broad scale. There was a very nice paper from them returning breast cancer variants to women who had these mutations and therefore had an elevated risk of breast cancer. And all of these women basically got the mutations validated. They got second opinions, and it just was information. So to me, information is power.
You don't think there's any risk? Because I know the FDA letter mentioned particularly BRCA analysis and the concern that women would take it as medical information. We had a genetic counselor, Ellen Matloff, on the program from Yale, and she knew of women who had actually had mastectomies and didn't need to, found out later.
Yeah, I don't think I've seen anything in the published literature along those lines, and I would certainly want to read that in more detail. What I've read and learned is that there have been women who have found out that they have these breast cancer mutations, and they have gotten second opinions, and in some cases they may have gone on and taken preventive measures. But I don't really know. I would have to see exactly what Dr. Matloff is referring to.
Mm-hmm. Now, we've been covering diagnostics quite a bit this past year, the diagnostics industry. And I think there's an overall consensus that we need to get the value up on diagnostics. And we had one doctor, and I think he's an oncologist, and I think he's a researcher, on the program talking about the vicious cycle in diagnostics, and that there were several nodes in this cycle that keep making it cycle down. Some people call it a race to the bottom, because it's been unregulated as far as the LDTs go. Companion diagnostics are a different story. And reimbursement has been sketchy, and then price is always, you know, dropping. And there's a lot in the industry who want to build that up, and they see that 23andMe is sort of coming along and not being part of that revolution. I mean, you talk about revolutions. And so what do you say about that?
Well, I mean, I think the LDT industry is it's a little different in the sense that, you know, 23andMe is trying to do a genome-wide microarray platform and trying to return whole genome data back to people. And I could imagine that in the future that they may want to or be able to segue into whole genome sequencing and being able to return whole genome data to individuals. And part of that is because they're, you know, they have backing from Google as well as other big data companies. I personally think the LDT industry, as you said, it is, you know, it's currently regulated by CMS, Centers for Medicare and Services, I believe is the name, and that's covered by something called CLIA. And yeah, there are thousands of people out there, thousands of LDTs that are being developed, but not really on a genome wide scale. To me, I'm mostly focused on the fact that 23andMe is doing something that is genome-wide rather than just on a gene-by-gene basis.
Genome-wide is important for discovering new diseases, such as the one you were working with. Is that it?
Yes, but also more importantly for really beginning to understand genomic background, and because really context matters. So like what I'm saying is that if you're a company that all you do is sell an LDT that screens for mutations in a single gene, mm-hmm. like BRCA1, then and you don't actually sequence or genotype the rest of that person's genome, then really you have no knowledge about their ancestry. You have no idea what population they come from. And so really you really cannot predict the expression of that particular mutation in that particular person, because you really have you're just doing the sequencing or the genotyping in complete isolation from the rest of their genome. And so for me, it's I find that 23andMe is potentially disruptive in the sense that they're doing genome-wide genotyping, and they have a very interesting ancestry determination algorithms, and so they can really start to help to put the mutations that they do identify in the context of each particular person's ancestry.
So it's a bigger picture, more complete picture, and they're the best ones offering that you've come across.
Yeah, I mean, I think the other thing is that although I would love for a nonprofit to try to do this, the problem is that there are a lot of obstacles to a global sort of genome-wide genotyping and sequencing, and part of it is limited by nation background, by nations.
Cultural background, yes.
Cultural and national interest. And so right now the United Kingdom is sequencing 100,000, planning to sequence 100,000 people, but it's not clear if that data is going to be released, all of it globally. And so if you look at Facebook and Twitter and Google, these kind of, and Apple, I mean, these companies are able to go global. And so to me, I would love to have a company like 23andMe be able to have millions of people who they're able to genotype and eventually sequence, and have millions of people entering phenotypic data, so that we can really begin to make really much better genotype phenotype predictions.
So once you go out of the corporate world, which can be quite boundaryless, into the nonprofit, it becomes more difficult.
Yes,
to get
for
that
sure.
global participation, because you know there's George Church's Personal Genome Project, but we also know that it hasn't gathered all the data that 23andMe has.
I mean, I think there are people out there who obviously would argue that this will occur potentially, but just more slowly with the Personal Genome Project. And I am myself a member of George Church's Personal Genome Project, and
oh, you are. Uh-huh.
I'm very much a supporter of that effort. And they have rolled out sites in America, Canada, and I think soon England. And over time, that very well could. It could develop into something that's much bigger, but I think right now they have maybe 2,000 participants in America, and I don't know how many they have in Canada or England, and that compares to 23andMe, which has at least 500,000, I think much more at this point, participants.
Right, right. Hey, before we go any further, I would like you to just say a bit more about the work that you did with the Ogden syndrome and work you're working on now and why you've come up with this view.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think what happened is that I have been myself over the last 5 years working with families in the state of Utah on various diseases that they have, and I've gotten to know some of the families and have begun to really appreciate through my clinical training as a psychiatrist that the expression of all disease is extraordinarily variable. And so even diseases that, some people consider to be quote unquote monogenic, like cystic fibrosis, are incredibly variably expressive. And so some, especially in families, you can see one individual that has a particular mutation in one gene, that person's phenotype is very severe, and then yet another individual with the same mutation and the same family, their disease may have a lot less severity. And so I've just gotten really interested in genomic background and how modifiers can affect phenotypic expression. And also now that I've been at Cold Spring Harbor for the last 2 years, I've been really reading a lot of the older literature from other organisms, including even bacteria, and just realizing that each particular gene has to be interpreted in the context of the entire rest of the genome, as well as the environment of that particular organism. And so it's just way more complicated than what many people are letting on currently.
Mm-hmm. But specifically, you had the case in Utah with the one child who had the Ogden syndrome. Ogden is a city in Utah, where you got the genetic tests of the family and couldn't share them back with the family. What happened there?
The trajectory of that was that that currently genetic information has to be obtained in a CLIA certified laboratory, and I had not gotten that result in a CLIA certified lab, and so.
Oh, I see. So that's pretty simple to solve now.
That is very simple to solve, and that's 23andMe solved that problem years ago by
right.
having their microarray. They get all their microarrays collected in CLIA certified labs, and that includes having your blood or your saliva, tracked in a very careful manner. But surprisingly, in the research enterprise, that's still not done. There's quite a large number of human genetics research that's being performed without adequate sample tracking and without any kind of CLIA-certified facility. And so really, it's almost impossible to give those results back to research participants because that research doesn't even meet the sort of minimum standard set out by CLIA.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the letter from the FDA to 23andMe. We talked about the BRCA concern over the BRCA results that the FDA raised. Another thing they raised in the letter, they mentioned the issue of warfarin dosage and pharmacogenetics, and talked about how it's the info on this is still sketchy and there's still a chance for people to be quite misled there.
I think that being able to tell your doctor that you are sensitive to warfarin and then having that doctor incorporate that into his or her medical decision making is totally appropriate. And I think also the FDA's warning letter, you know, basically said that they feared that women were going to be going out and getting double mastectomies. But you know, in fact, there's no surgeon that I'm aware of that would ever do a mastectomy on a woman unless he had validated, you know, had validated the genetic finding and gotten that person genetic counseling. And also the paper that 23andMe published in the PeerJ journal actually revealed that by doing the BRCA1 and 2 mutation screening, they were able to identify other people in the family that might be susceptible to cancer. And so, you know, it really has to do with paternalism versus libertarianism, and in the sense of, do you want to give people information and try to help people reveal things about themselves, or do you prefer to sort of keep information away from people and, you know, try to prevent people from somehow hurting themselves?
Mm-hmm. How would you contrast it with therapeutics?
Therapeutics is therapeutics is something that's built into the culture of America, in the sense that the pharmaceutical industry has made billions of dollars basically peddling drugs to many, many people. And preventive medicine is something that has really not taken hold in America. Partly due to the fact that there's such a huge emphasis on developing new drugs, when in fact, I think what 23andMe is doing is trying to help alert people to their risk of developing certain diseases, and then trying to prevent those diseases by either implementing, you know, exercise or diet interventions, or treating people with medications much earlier in the course of the disease. And so it really does come down to a major cultural change in terms of trying to emphasize preventive medicine rather than treating people after the fact with very expensive drugs that basically are mainly meant to help the pharmaceutical industry make money.
What about the patients that are helped by them?
Obviously, therapeutics are useful for many people. But as a practicing psychiatrist, I have all too often seen an enormous amount of sort of pushing of drugs and off label. Unfortunately, I've had the displeasure of off label marketing. And you know, for example, the drug Seroquel is prescribed way too often for insomnia. It's a very, very powerful antipsychotic medication that I have personally prescribed to people with psychotic episodes. But it seems as though that medication is being used to treat insomnia in a lot of people, and that has to do with off-market labeling, in my opinion.
But do you think FDA, do you think we have a culture of paternalism with therapeutics? Or do you think that they're right to be regulated?
No, I think therapeutics, I think something that enters your body definitely deserves a higher level of regulation than information. So I've tried to make very clear in my writings and public discourse that I feel like the FDA has a very strong role to play with medications and herbal supplements and anything, or and even medical devices, anything that's going to actually physically enter your body, possibly cause damage. I feel like the FDA should be spending its time and resources on being much more active in regulating herbal supplements than it is with just regulating the dissemination of information.
Mm-hmm. What about companion diagnostics? Are specific diagnostics, and you could say it's just information, right? That have been paired up with a particular therapeutic to target a specific population. I mean, this is seen as a big promise for personalized medicine.
Yeah, and once again, I do think that definitely falls squarely in the purview of the FDA. I think the minute that you are trying to sell an expensive medication that's going to enter humans, that yes, if people using that medication is predicated on the result of a particular test, then that companion diagnostic should be strictly scrutinized. I think that you know, my I've been trying to walk this fine line over the last 3 years that, you know, that research should fall within CLIA, that if you're going to be doing genotyping or sequencing, that it ought to be done in a CLIA certified environment, including, you know, the sample collection and tracking, so that you can actually give that genome wide information back to people. But I've been also saying that I don't think that that should fall within strict regulation by the FDA. But unfortunately, as I tried to say earlier in the conversation, there are some research labs, many research labs, that have not taken that advice and are, you know, going on doing lots of sequencing and genotyping and in non-CLIA environments. And
so do you think that's partly led to the FDA cracking down, that there's been so much non-CLIA work done?
I think that people tend to blur. I think they sort of, you know, they see people doing research in non-CLIA environments, and then, you know, they, you know, I don't want to speculate on what has been said behind closed doors. The FDA, but if you sort of try to lump 23andMe in with, you know, all those quote unquote researchers who are doing things without any kind of CLIA regulation, then, you know, in my opinion, that's what can that may be part of what is at play here. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's I do see what you mean by walking the fine line. On the one hand, you actually want to see research be done in a more regulated environment, which is CLIA. And then you're saying the outcome of that would be good for the clinical setting or the doctor-patient setting, which is not research, that outside of research, that world would be improved, I guess, if research was more regulated.
Yeah, and I just want to clarify that I'm talking here about specifically genome-wide genotyping microarrays or genome-wide things involving sequencing, like exome sequencing, which is where you sequence the entire all the exons of the human genome, or also whole genome sequencing. I'm not saying that all research, you know, including cell lines and all sorts of other things, should be done in CLIA environments.
That would be prohibitive. I get your point there.
Incredibly expensive. You know, all I'm saying is that if you're going to be doing genome-wide genotyping and sequencing of human beings, it ought to be done in a CLIA environment so that you can return that data to the participants, and so that they can also derive value from that information.
What do you see as the biggest danger of the FDA, what you would say being paternalistic, overstepping?
Well, it's what I wrote in my commentary that I published in a blog called The Conversation, and I basically just said it's going to delay the revolution that medicine needs. And what I meant by that is that until we have genome-wide information on each person, and until we can sort of put each person in the context of their own particular family tree, which would be made possible by that genome-wide information, that it's going to be very we're going to sort of continue to live in this world of genetic determinism, where people are just going to be using LDTs to just sequence a single gene, or you're going to have these very limited targeted panels where people might sequence 1,000 genes, but then, you know, they're not going to be putting that into the context of the entire genome. And to me, each person is unique, and each person probably has, you know, definitely has lots of modifying loci. And so if you just sort of say person has mutation in gene X, and you take that totally out of the context of their entire genome and the ancestry of their immediate family tree, it almost is, it's not as meaningful as if you had much more contextual information. And so by the FDA coming in and basically saying that, that they're not willing to allow 23andMe to sort of collect genome-wide information and try to provide that back to people, and do some medical interpretation of it in order to provide value to those participants, I think it's just going to delay the sort of more widespread dissemination of direct-to-consumer genetic testing.
And what if someone argued, as long as it protects patients, it's worth the delay?
Right, and so that's why I said it's a delay. It's, you know, and so, you know, this is something that, you know, it'll eventually happen. I think that,
you know, 23andMe actually filed for the clearance. Now, they did so because the FDA had told them to. But what if they had kept that open? We all are wondering why that got stopped. What if they had kept the communication open and kept working toward that to get some kind of a clearance?
Well, I think they still are. I think there was an announcement from them, from 23andMe, saying that they, you know, they're no longer going to do the medical, they're not providing the medical interpretation at this point, and they are going to start to work again with the FDA. And so I think, you know, over the next, you know, 5 to 10 years, I mean, some people would probably hope it's shorter than that, but I'm a little bit more on the cynical side. I would. You know, say that it might take 5 to 10 years to sort of prove that these genotyping microarrays are providing clinically interpretable information. And it's really going to come down to the discussions between 23andMe and the FDA. So, and exactly what are they going to want, somehow some sort of trials to be performed for each and every variant that they're going to be returning? And so sort of to just to make that concrete, currently, the genotyping array from 23andMe has 3 of these breast cancer mutations. And is the FDA really going to want some sort of in clinical interpretation data for each and every one of those 3 variants? And then how's that going to scale to potentially thousands to eventually millions of variants that will be revealed in each person with whole genome sequencing?
Mm. Do you have any idea how that might go forward at this point?
Well, I think it'll be very, very slow.
Slow. It'll be one at a time.
Well, that's what I fear will be the case, is that mm-hmm.
I've heard that the FDA has approved already an array in the past.
But not direct to consumer. They've you know, the not to my knowledge, there's nothing that they've approved where you can do an array and then give that data directly back to participants.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you talk about, you know, you say medicine needs a revolution. This is going to delay it. Can you, as we finish up here, describe that revolution? And I mean, I see you on Twitter all the time. You at conferences. You're quite involved in the conversation about genomic medicine. What are your thoughts in the bigger picture?
I mean, I would like to see the world become a more of a global place, and I feel like it is starting to happen with Twitter and Facebook, with more and more people connecting up with each other, and there are plenty of people out there that are quite capable of uploading data, including pictures of themselves, to things like Facebook, and I would like to sort of reach a time when more and more people are globally interconnected, and it would like to get to a world where we have millions of whole genomes sequenced with very detailed longitudinal phenotyping data. And one company that's working toward the phenotype end of things is patients like me, where people can go on and log in and put in phenotype data. There's also the Genetic Alliance, which is helping to sort of connect and empower communities of people with rare diseases to work together. And so you can sort of see that it's possible that we may get to a world of millions of people interconnected with being able to upload and share their whole genome and phenotype data. But I think there's going to be a lot of hiccups along the way, and that's why Kai Wang, a close collaborator, and myself, we published a paper last year in Genome Medicine where we prayed that by the year 2062, which was 50 years away from the date of publication, we prayed and hoped that at least in the industrialized world, that in 50 years' time, every newborn will get their genome sequenced and that they'll have that data available to them. And I hope that we'll get to that world at least in 50 years.
Golson Lyon, who identified a new genetic disease, Ogden syndrome, is an assistant professor at Cold Spring Harbor. Thank you for taking the time.
Great, thank you.
Find out how to promote your brand by underwriting quality content. Go to mendelspot.com/underwriting.
This is Theral Timpson with Mandelspod. Thank you for listening.